We also forgot to sign up here.
From the Oregon State Farm Business and Corporate Law Center.
All right, Stephen Babson, would he be speaking for the chief sponsor of this bill, do you think? Come on up.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, we have a witness who has to leave, and I'd ask your consent to have him come up front now.
Sure, get his. Two of you from the Business and Corporate Law section of the bar, and that we've got here now?
No, we have another interested party.
All right. Go ahead. Who's going to speak first?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Ted Achilles for the record. My address is 18300 South Whitten Lane in West Lynn. I'm speaking for myself and from the perspective of a small businessman, not an attorney, in favor of Senate Bill 390.
Okay.
And from our point of view, as a small company with about 100, 110 employees, a high-tech company, we see philosophically just a continuing trend on the part of management to push the decision base down further and further amongst the employees to attempt to create within the employee group a far more aware group of employees, and I think the old notion of an autocratic management where this restricted knowledge is at the top of the company is really archaic. So from our point of view, dealing as we do significantly with many different regulatory agencies, and the FAA in particular, it would be a situation where if an attorney were to be representing us and to do an adequate job of representing us as a client, there would be very real need on his part to be able to interview our employees really right down to quite junior level employees within our engineering group. So for an attorney to do a correct job from our point of view, representing us correctly, it would be important to us that he have access to literally all of our employees, and that the privilege be extended all the way down the line.
Okay. Did you tell us about your business?
No, it's an electronics company that makes navigation equipment for aircraft, and the main regulatory agency we deal with is the FAA.
Can you give us a living example of the type of contact that the lower echelon people might have with your attorney, or this kind of a situation that you think this bill might be able to correct?
Well, we've had no direct situations that relate to the bill, but one that I might contemplate is that as we seek certification for one of our products and get FDA approval to market this kind of a product, this is a negotiation process that goes on for perhaps 6 months or 9 months or a year, and it's probably done by the most part by members of our engineering group, including in some instances fairly junior people. So if there were to be a problem, if we transgressed along the way and did something inadvertently against the regulations imposed on us by the FAA, and required an attorney to represent us in that regard, we would want him to be able to communicate with the fellow who might be just 2 or 3 years out of school in our engineering group, and certainly not a part of senior management, and certainly not one of the people within our firm who is authorized to engage professional counsel.
Okay. Mr. Babson, go ahead.
My name is Stephen Babson. I'm a partner in the Washington County.
Excuse me, Mr. Achilles, I didn't mean that you had to get up and leave, because maybe somebody had a question to ask of you. So if anybody wanted to ask a question, I didn't mean to excuse the witness. I meant for him to sit there. But no, it's all right. Go ahead. Now, who have you got? Mr. Richardson?
Yes.
Okay, Gene Richardson now.
Correct.
Okay, Mr. Babson's going to speak first. Go ahead.
I would suggest if anyone does have a question for Mr. Achilles, he does have to get to the airport, and I'd be happy to defer to questions to him now.
Any questions of Mr. Achilles? Okay.
Has met him before. Mr. Achilles was Representative Achilles for 2 or 3 sessions
I haven't.
Clackamas County.
And,
had an outstanding career in business before he came to the legislature, and is now staying legislator.
Well, welcome back to the Marble Halls.
Thank you very much.
I guess you can go ahead and take off for the airport then.
Thank you
very much. We hope to see him again, Mr. Chair, in the Marble Halls.
I don't know that much about him, so I don't know what I'll do. Okay, Mr. Babson, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Stephen Babson. I'm a partner in the Washington County office of Stoll, Reeves, Bully, Fraser, and Wise, and I'm a member of the Executive Committee of the Business and Corporate Law Section, which is sponsoring the bill. The bill stated simply would expand the scope of attorney-client privilege provided in ORS 40.225 to include, in addition to people viewed as being in control of or in control of the corporation, employees, principals, and others who, in the course of their responsibilities, have access to, provide information to attorneys, and receive and carry out advice from attorneys. I'm sure you're all familiar with this concept. It's an issue that's been around the legislature for some time. It dates back to 1974 when the Advisory Committee on Evidence Law Review was charged with developing an evidence code for the state of Oregon, which they did, and in approaching the attorney-client privilege issue, had a specific definition of representative of the client that was analogous to what we are proposing today. In the course of hearings on the code, the scope of privilege provided in that bill was narrowed considerably to what we will call now the control group test, which was subsequently enacted into law. On or about the time the legislature was considering this issue, the Supreme Court handed down its Upjohn decision in which it rejected the control group test as applied to federal rules of evidence. In 1983, House Bill 2310 was proposed, which again would have expanded the privilege in a manner analogous to the bill you're considering now. That bill passed the House 54-1, it was referred to the Senate, and got tabled at some point during the session. I want to give you three reasons why I think this bill should be adopted, and they all are germane to how it affects my practice. I think the control group test that is presently in effect undermines public policy, which favors communications between counsel and client. Basically, that's why we have the privilege. And that privilege, I should point out, exists not only to our giving advice to client and employee, but also our need to get information from employees of a client in order to give sound advice. And if the purpose of privilege is to be served, the attorney and the client must be able to predict what conversations will be protected. Second, I believe the control group test ignores the practical and legal realities of the way in which associations and organizations do business. Mr. Achilles spoke to you about the increasing decentralization of decision making. Employees beyond the control group possess the information that attorneys need to know, and employees beyond the control group will be charged with carrying out advice provided by counsel. Employees beyond the control group can subject the employer to liability, and it seems only fair that if a corporate employee can render the corporation liable for damages or other penalties, he should also have the power to make confidential communications to his counsel concerning the liability. Just a note of clarification on this bill and its predecessors have never amounted to an attempt to cause different business organizations to be subject to different rules on privilege. I think there's been some misunderstanding of that in the past, and if you look at the example cited in the 1981 legislative summary, I think that's an incorrect summary of how this bill would apply a privilege, and I think in the example the privilege would extend both to the incorporated association and the unincorporated association. For these reasons, I submit that the bill should be passed and will be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions of Mr. Babson? All right, Mr. Grafton, thank you. Did you want to add something, Mr. Richardson?
Yes, just briefly, Mr. Chairman. Try not to go over the same points. Just a couple of things. I'm employed by Floating Point Systems as corporate counsel, and I'm also a member of the Business Corporate Law Section Executive Committee and chairman of a subcommittee of that group, which is a committee of people who are employed as house counsels of corporations. So I'd just like to add just one point, as Mr. Achilles talked about with a 100-person corporation. Throughout the period when I've had the privilege of having been employed by Floating Point Systems, I've seen our company grow from about 100 people to about 1,400 employees worldwide that we have now. And as he talks about the decentralization of management for a 100-person company, you can. You know, I just want to reiterate that in a company of our size, it's even much, much greater and almost impossible to centralize some kind of control of relevant information at one or two or three people at the top as it relates to activities that might cause the corporation legal ramifications. I think secondly, and about the only positive aspects that you could have when you're looking at an in-house counsel relationship are really two. One, the opportunity to hopefully practice preventive law. In other words, be involved in things before they result in some kind of negative consequence. And secondly, and coming and needed for that, is the access to people throughout the company, not just the chairman and the president and hopefully the directors. And this bill would greatly improve the ability of these people, especially in-house counsel, to have access in a comfortable sense to the people that they need to have access to carry out these responsibilities.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, Mr. Richardson? All right, gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, Mr. Ringo.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Ringo, box 605 Jefferson, Corvallis, Oregon. I practice law. I noticed this committee is the business and corporate law section, and it was very interesting to me that this committee was not the procedure and practice section of the Oregon State Bar, and it didn't come out of the litigation section of the Oregon State Bar, the people that live with the results of this. Every text writer we read lately, the judges and all, continually discuss how we must open up the process and quit hiding the facts and quit hiding the information and quit hiding the truth. That trials should no longer be a paper chase for the truth that is hidden. The dilemma of this bill, it extends the coverage far beyond what the proposers really understand. Rule 36 of the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. Now, this committee is well aware of the Commission Council on Court Procedure and that they write the rules of civil procedure subject to the concurrence of this legislature. That Rule 36 of the Rules of Civil Procedure gives the scope of discovery and what you can discover and what you cannot discover. And it's an attempt to let a little light and to quit playing this game of ambush. Rule 36 has to be read in conjunction with the rules of evidence, which is Rule 102 of the rules of evidence of the courts. Rule 102 recites, the Oregon Evidence Code shall be construed to secure fairness in administration, elimination of unjustifiable expense and delay, promotion of growth and development of the law of evidence, to the end that truth may be ascertained and proceedings justice determined. This bill would just slam a garage door on the search for truth, and that's all it does. I can give you a very clear recent example. Some people purchased a four-wheel drive pickup on Friday. They heard a scraping noise on Sunday. Monday, they're taken back to the dealer when the front wheel locks, plunges into the ditch with terrible injuries. On Tuesday, the General Motors service manager and the dealer service manager examined the bearings in the spindle. With this bill, a person cannot ask them what they saw and what they found.
Well, wait a minute now.
That is right, Senator Frye, because this bill says any employee...
I know, but we're talking about communications, aren't we?
There's verbal communication. You can't ask them what their notes were. You can't ask them what they reported on up the line.
I don't think I follow you on that.
All right. This bill says this.
That doesn't sound like a communication between a lawyer and his client to me.
But it's held. See, anybody's protected with work product. That's not what we're talking about. They talk about the lawyer going down and talking to somebody. That is work product. That's already protected. That's already protected.
Well, wait a minute now. But you said that the serviceman who went down and examined the spindle and the
bearing
would be this bill would preclude you as the attorney for the injured people from asking him what he saw
and what memo he wrote up, what his findings were. That's right, because it says an employee, and a representative client means an employee who provides the client's lawyer with information which was acquired during the course or as a result of such person's relationship with the client as, use the word employee, and by means of which information the client may obtain legal advice or legal services. What they're saying in that bill is the corporation is the client, and the employee, when he furnishes that information, that's not going to be discoverable under our present rules of civil procedure. And that is the net effect of this bill. There isn't any reason. Nobody's talking about work product or confidential communications. This bill would close inquiry as to the employees.
Okay, any questions?
Senator Wires.
That's the effect of it.
You're saying that once the employee tells the lawyer that's either defending the corporation or works for the corporation, then not only the conversation itself, but the subject matter of it then becomes confidential?
Yes.
Why can't you ask the employee, what did you find when you inspected the part that you mentioned?
Because the answer is going to be, what I found was part of my communication to the council. There's no reason to pass this bill except to just to further limit any discovery of truth. You're going to have to abide by Section 102 or not.
But I'm just trying to zero in on that one thing.
Sure.
You're saying that once, in other words, once it's communicated to the council, then it couldn't afterward be inquired after.
That's the reading of this language.
Not only can't they ask, what did you tell council, but you're saying you couldn't ask what they observed.
That's all part of that.
Well, any other questions? Okay, Mr. Engel, thank you. Anybody who might have come in late that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 390? The sponsors of the bill want to respond by a letter to the committee staff, well, you're welcome to do that. All right, that'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 390. Now, there is another bill I kind of overlooked here that doesn't have anything to do with these four bills in uniform state law, so I guess we'll take care of it, and that's the Oregon State Bar Bill on Senate Bill 580. We'll go to that next, and then we'll take up these remaining bills. Have we got somebody here in 580?
I don't think we've got another bill in 580.
Okay. Why? Did you want to explain why again?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
We have 580 is scheduled because we have another bill that we are dealing with in committee that we've dealt with, and it's Senate Bill 858 that contains all of the same provisions.
Okay.
898, I'm sorry, that contains all of the same provisions that Senate Bill 580 does, plus some additional provisions dealing with the status of the bar as to whether it's a public corporation, state agency, instrumentality, or whatever other words they threw in.
Yeah.
This was scheduled because it is a subject that the committee has dealt with. I didn't know if they wanted to dispose of it.
All right. Well, I think we don't need this with the other one. All right. Anybody see
we
any
do
reason?
Not need this.
We do not need 580 with
it. And the other is alive and well.
Yes, that's the one we talked about yesterday. I hope we'll.
Is this a work session?
Finish up on.
Is this a work session, Mr. Chair?
You can take final action on a bill.
Okay.
Public
I'll
hearing.
So move.
Table. Senator Hammond moves the table, Senate Bill 580. Call the roll, please.
Brockman. Brown.
Aye.
Bailey?
Aye.
Abby?
Aye.
Simmons?
Aye.
Fry?
Aye. Motion carries. Okay. Now let's go to Senate Bill. Let me ask Bogie Young and his guests from Chicago if there's any particular order, or does it make any difference what order we take these bills in terms of...
I don't think it makes any difference. We might just as well take them numerically.
All right, let's do that then. We'll go to Senate Bill 585. Oh, wait a minute. That's not the one I want. 585? Yes, that's right. 585, we've only got one witness signed up on that.
Hopefully that'll make it simple.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John McCabe. I'm legal counsel and legislative director for the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws with offices in Chicago. And I'm here today at the request of the Oregon Uniform Law Commissioners to help with the package of uniform law legislation. I hope I remember to pronounce Oregon correctly.
Oh, yeah.
I always get caught on that.
Well,
I get caught on that every time I've been The first bill we have, which is Senate Bill 585, is really the longest of the group and probably the most difficult to access to get into. It is substantively the 1977 amendments to the Uniform Commercial Code, which are the amendments to Article 8 of the Uniform Commercial Code, Article 8 being that article which governs securities transfers, securities being stocks and bonds, basically. And it has been the law in this country, certainly since the Uniform Commercial Code completed the adoption rounds in the mid-1960s, but even well before that, because the basis for Article 8, which is the certificate of transfer, has been the law in this country for well over 100 years, and it was part and parcel of the earlier acts that preceded the Uniform Commercial Code. So we are dealing with a revision of Article 8, which attempts to introduce a new idea, an effort to essentially modernize or to provide the basis for modernization of securities transfers in the United States. Excuse me. The impetus for these amendments came out of the American Bar Association and came out of actually the crunch, the so-called paper crunch of the 1960s in the securities industry. At that time, the transactions and the number of transfers arose so greatly with respect to stocks and bonds that the handling of the paper became an enormous problem. So they began to make people think that perhaps there was a better way. There is another alternative to the certificate as the means to transfer interests in stocks and bonds. At the same time, in the 1960s, we were beginning to see the development of automation in this country, all kinds of transfer capacities through computers and understanding that the technology was going to become more and more available. So that again was an impetus, something that caused people to think maybe not only is there a better way, but we can also provide a means for making securities transfers that will accommodate new technology. In the mid-1970s, the American Bar Association's Committee on Stock Certificates concluded a report which suggested a new way, the so-called certificateless transfer, and in their report suggested that the Uniform Law Commissioners take up the Uniform Law Commissioners and its companion in the Uniform Commercial Code, the American Law Institute, take up the principle of new amendments, and we completed these in 1977. They're now the law in 18 jurisdictions in the United States, including very important jurisdictions from the point of view of securities transfers. New York, for example, has adopted this act, or these amendments.
Did you say 18?
18, yes. Delaware has adopted the amendments to this act. The state of California has adopted the Article 8 amendments. The state of Texas has adopted the Article 8 amendments. The state of Massachusetts has done so, and the state of Ohio has done so. Now, I mention those states for this reason, that if you look at securities transfers in the United States, trading in stocks and bonds, I've named the majority of the 10 largest trading states, of which, of course, New York is far and away the most enormous leader. And in fact, we did not really try to propose this act in very many legislatures until New York had adopted it, for the very reason that the leading state had to do it before everybody else could really be asked to do it. And that being done, we are now asking all of the states to begin adopting this. Indeed, we want to, as we have with the Uniform Commercial Code, establish uniformity across the country. We want to, as rapidly as possible, regain uniformity with the adoption of these amendments as well. So we are now particularly asking all state legislatures to look at the Article 8 amendments. Now, as I indicated before, the basis for securities transfers has been the paper, the certificate, the piece of paper that represents the interest that is a security under this act. Now, a security is an intangible, stock, a share of stock or a bond is an intangible. And so for the purposes of transferring, we have always looked as the paper, at the paper, at the certificate itself, as if it was the fundamental basis for the transaction in the intangible. It represents the intangible in every way. So that if you buy or sell stock, or you buy or sell bonds, or you give stock, or you give bonds, or you use them as security for a debt, the issue always is where's the certificate, and what is the situation with the certificate. And the basic means of transfer is by endorsement and delivery. That is, you put the appropriate signatures, just like a check, on the certificate, and you transfer it from transferor to transferee in whatever character that particular transfer is. Now, of course, that's an oversimplification of the securities markets and the way that they work, because when you, of course, are dealing with brokerages, with financial intermediaries who are involved in all of this, with transfer agents, with the existing Depository Trust Corporation and analogous clearinghouses, you're dealing in a much more sophisticated kind of market than that simple analogy suggests. But the fact is that the certificate, or the fiction of the certificate, has been very important and remains very important with respect to the whole transfer system. This act would attempt, or these amendments would attempt, to offer an alternative which would provide essentially certificate-less transfers. And indeed, we talk about certificated transfers in this act, and we talk about uncertificated transfers. Now, what the amendments attempt to do is to establish in the existing body of Article 8, which of course deals with the certificate and the certificated transfers as is, to provide the amendments which would introduce the concept of the uncertificated transfer. It attempts to do it in a fashion that disrupts Article 8, the existing Article 8, in the least way. And it is established in an effort to try to obtain a certain kind of parity or equality between the two transfer systems, so that there is no reason to choose because of the character of the law, that is, a corporation or an issuer who's interested in creating certificates or creating securities, can really decide on factors of marketing, factors of logistics of the particular company, factors of the economic situation, factors of technology available, on whether they're going to go certificateless or certificated, as in the traditional way, and to do so on those factors, not because the law somehow biases one system or the other. Now, this bill is relatively long, but I think the system idea that it prepares or provides is not really that complicated, and is relatively easy to describe. What happens in a certificateless transfer? Well, fundamentally, the transfer becomes effective when it takes place on the issuer's books, on the books of the corporate entity that is issuing the certificate. Now, in order for there to be a transfer on the books, a couple of things have to happen. One is, and the Act provides for what is defined and called an instruction, which is either a writing or a mechanism or a device by contract between the issuer and the transferor of a particular security, that is to say, the owner of a share of stock. The instruction being going to the issuer to provide the instructions of the transfer, whether it's transfer for sale, transfer for whatever, for a pledge. An instruction goes from the current owner or transferor to the issuer. The issuer, upon receiving the instruction, has the duty and responsibility within a two business day period, to return a notice, essentially, of the transfer that goes to the transferor, that goes to the transferee. If it happens to be a pledge, if you're pledging for a debt, it will go to transferor, it will go to the pledgee. That document, that notice, is called an ITS, or an initial transaction statement, and it contains a number of items of information important to the transferor and the transferee to indicate that the transfer has taken place on the issuer's books. that those two items, the instruction and the initial transaction statement, essentially are the two indications between the three parts of the transaction, which is from transferor to the corporate issuer and back to the transferee, of the existence of the transfer, and all of the rights and effects of that transfer stem from, arise from, the two documents, or the two, although the instruction may not necessarily be a document, but from the instruction and from the initial transaction statement. And that's basically the way the thing works. Not really that difficult conceptually, although when you look at the bill, you will find incorporating it into the existing act does take a little bit of doing. There are a number of things that you have to accomplish, such as dealing with issues of signature guarantees, with the warranties of transfer, which are part and parcel of Article 8, with third-party rights. These are kinds of things that you have to accommodate for in the new system as we have provided for them in the certificated system. And the Act indeed deals with all of those issues. It also deals with issues pertaining to the existences of what are called intermediaries.
Bringing some certainty to it, and I think the long and short of it is it is, in that sense, a somewhat arbitrary number, but it is a certain number.
Yeah. Repose rather than any other reason. Okay. I had a couple more questions. You used the word conclusively in your testimony. Did you really mean conclusively? If you prove that, then conclusively, there's no discretion in the trier of fact?
Well, I think that's true for one section of the Act, which I think is 5B, when there's an insider transfer. Let me see if I can find that.
Page 3. Oh, 31.
And I think that there, in that situation, it is a conclusive presumption of fraud under 5B, where you're talking, for instance, where there's a transfer that's made to an insider, a relative, or some other entity that qualifies as an insider, and the debtor is insolvent at the time, and the insider had reason to believe that there was insolvency. And I think under that section, but correct me if I'm wrong, that would be a conclusive presumption.
This has been long been known as a kind of badge of fraud concept.
Yeah, I do understand that. And I'm just trying to come from the transition of equity protecting the court from doing, assisting in inequity by sticking with the legal form and getting around the legal form so that the court won't be complicit with the inequity, over to what is involved here in this case. Where we are giving, it seems to me, the creditor an additional standing of some kind, but I'm not positive that that's the intent of the Act. conclusive presumptions are unusual in Oregon, Mr. McCabe, and I need
well,
to
I think
that.
The whole, your question is, I understand that we don't usually think of legal actions being per se actions, or we don't usually think in terms of these bad fraud actions. The old Fraudulent Conveyance Act had badge of fraud. The Bankruptcy Act, I believe, operates on a similar basis. And the reason for it being that in certain fact circumstances, proof of such things is intent. Appropriate knowledge is very, very difficult. And so once you surround the concept with it in the right way, you have to show the insolvency, for example. You have to show the insider character of the transaction. The theory being that without showing the intent, you've essentially shown a transaction which is fraudulent to credit.
Right.
These are very narrow. I think these are very narrow causes of action, very narrow concepts, the way the Act frames.
I didn't say what I was trying to say a minute ago very well. We would leave a little discretion with the judge, since it was his moral sense that was the basis for the action and then the basis for the decision about what to do about it. And when you get to conclusive presumption, you don't leave any discretion with the trier of fact, the judge, anymore. That's why I talked about it being a transition. Value, the use of the word value in the
back a time or two. I want to understand what value means a little bit here. And I gave an example of a gift because of momentary insanity, having won the lottery a minute ago. But this seems to say that even if I have tremendous love and affection and I'm probably dying of congestive heart failure, I can't give property that has no lien on it to my daughter because she's not going to give me value back. Question. Is love and affection, is that a value here? It doesn't say it is.
Wouldn't be reasonably equivalent value. I think that's right.
Well, now you don't know my daughter.
I simply tell you the definition of the act.
I understand. I shouldn't have gotten country with
again, you have to look at it in the context of the whole action. The issue you raised is raised under Section 4, which requires either proof of some kind of intent or some kind of knowledge. That is, a state of fact to indicate that the debtor had some intention of defrauding the creditor, making the transfer with that intention wrong. And I put in that context, and the state of proof that is necessary, it seems to me that the whole issue becomes a good deal more cognizable, including the value issue. If somebody makes a transfer, it's easy to make a transfer. Let's say you're anticipating going into debt. One of the easiest kinds of transfers to make is interfamilial transfer. Making that transfer, you can say, well, if you did not restrict value, you can say, well, I certainly got my value out of it. Yeah. The affection that my spouse is giving me, my child is giving me, or whatever. But the probable case is that we're probably dealing with a situation in which there's an effort to defraud, and therefore that ought to be raisable as a kind of defense.
And that's possible, but since we've covered the idea that I could make the gift when I was solvent, and if I later created a debt which made me insolvent, the initial gift not being for equivalent value, meaning money's worth kind of value, would be set aside.
And I don't think that's necessarily.
No, that initial gift would not be set aside unless there were enough evidence to indicate that it fitted one of those categories which indicated an intent to defraud.
Specifically.
We're going to have to put you up there on the mic because you're talking so much and we're not getting it on the tape here now.
Let me go ahead and add a thing or two to my homely fact situation there. I've got congestive heart failure, and I think I'm going to have a heart transplant, and when I give her the money, I get heart money, but if I go to Louisville and have a heart transplant, that'll cost so much I'll be broke afterward. But I know I may have to have one. So I'm going to incur debt for a heart transplant in the future, which will make me broke because it's so high priced. Can the Humana Association set aside the transfer to my daughter?
I think they may very well, might very well be able to.
I'll be doggone.
Founder Pastor.
Better give it to her now while my heart's sound.
Senator?
That's good advice in any case.
You raised a fact situation where the individual made the transfer while that person was solvent, and then subsequent to the transfer became insolvent, and a debt was created.
Yeah.
I believe that under the Act, the creditor will only have a cause of action if, as a result of that transfer, either the person was insolvent at the time the transfer was made or became insolvent as a result of the transfer.
Well, I thought it said he knew he was going to incur a debt later that would make him insolvent, or intended to.
In terms of the objective tests, that is what the test would be under the objective tests. And you would have to put together some of those circumstances as set out under 4B. That would be one of the.
Yeah. And you put the. I don't understand the new Bankruptcy Act, but I know that anytime anybody goes bankrupt, you can attack transfers they have made for a prior period. The period may be a limited amount of time, but you can attack any transfer.
a person can go bankrupt without knowing they're going to when they make the transfer, but you still set the transfer aside even if they didn't know about it. And that is simply to grab a hold of whatever pie there was there and to back up to yesterday's slice of pie too and then spread it fairly. That's different than the traditional or old idea of a fraudulent transfer. It wasn't intended to be fraudulent, but the debt came along. In my fact situation, it's kind of an involuntary debt I'm talking about. I have the choice of dying and having a cheap burial, in which event my daughter can still keep the gift I gave her, or I can try to live and incur a large debt trying to live, and in that event, my daughter doesn't keep the gift.
Any other questions?
No. Thank you. I've had as much fun as I could at 6 o'clock.
I wonder if Senator Schumer would leave that choice up to his daughter.
She'd be for the chief general.
All right, thank you very much.
I should say, just one final, there was an early question about whether the act had been adopted. I just looked at the most recent list that got in the office before coming here, and we have an adoption. That happens to be North Dakota. It also has had 7 introductions besides Oregon in 7 legislatures this year.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
That'll conclude the public hearing on Senate Bill 595. Now, I intended to call these bills up in chronological order, and I'm looking at Wynn Calkins, who's sitting over there signing up on 588, and I skipped right over it. And I'm sorry about that, Wynn, but I tell you what, it's more timely that you come up now because I want Senator Feeley to listen to the story, too.
I'll listen.
The reason it's more timely for you to come up now than it would have been before we talked about this Uniform Act and fraudulent transfers is because I was barely out of law school and maybe I was still a law clerk, I don't remember. But anyway, I had this assignment given to me by this lawyer that I was working for. It was a fraudulent conveyance thing, and I was struggling. I walked across the street from this law office, and this old well-known lawyer was out there sweeping the leaves off his sidewalk. It was Wynn Calkins' grandfather, S.M. Calkins. I said, Mr. Calkins, can you kind of help me get started on this problem that I've got? And he took me in this little house, a little cottage there, and in the back was their library, and he pulled down some books, and he kind of looked in there, and he told me how to get started. But when I look back, I think about this fraudulent conveyance case, and I think now I've got in front of me here at this committee hearing the third generation of a well-known legal family in Eugene. Nice to have you here, Wynn. You're signed up on Senate Bill 588, and you're here representing you're a commissioner, I believe, are you not, with the Uniform State Laws Commission?
Yes, and member of the State Bar Committee on Uniform State Laws, too.
Another member is Oglesby Young, who's president. And who's the third member of the commission?
Janice Snow.
We've got the whole commission with us today. Right. Fine. All right. Well, identify yourself for the record and tell us where you live and proceed with your testimony.
Wynn Calkins from Eugene, Oregon, and I practice law there. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee and Mr. Swank, legal counsel, it's my privilege to make a few opening remarks on behalf of Senate Bill 588. I do myself sweep leaves from time to time, even at this late date. It's probably in the same location.
Yeah, but the cottage isn't there anymore, is it?
No, it's gone. We've got towering buildings and kind of live in a canyon down there right now, but
right.
It's still the same location.
Well, Senator Feeley, of course, remembers not only your grandfather real well, but also the cottage, because I don't think it was torn down until, well, you were probably in college.
1960s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had the impression it might even be 4 generations.
Well, there was a justice of the peace back there, but
the 4SM.
Yeah,
right. Thank you.
The Senate Bill 588 is basically the uniform law on limited partnerships. I had the privilege of attending the Uniform Law Commissioners meeting in 1977 where this was adopted. And since that time, state bar committees have looked at the bill, and in the last 2 years, there's been a great deal of activity in studying it by the Uniform State Law Committee and the business and a corporation section, and we've had joint meetings together with them. They've had a few minor changes in the act, but the basic aspects of the act are still the Uniform Limited Partnership Act as it's adopted in its revised form in 1977 by the National Law Commissioners. Also, we've worked with the Corporation Commissioner's Office, Mr. Bob Lintott, and Corporation Commissioner Edwards as well, in working out some of the mechanical facets of this act, and we spent from 2:30 up until almost 5 today working with them. They have a set of amendments which Mr. Larpenter, who's here on behalf of the corporate and business section, and I have gone over, and we basically approve of those changes. What the Corporation Commissioner is attempting to do is make these amendments coordinate with the other sections of our statutes with which they have responsibilities, and this didn't arise after out of this act coming up, but out of an overall plan which they are presenting at this legislature to coordinate all these acts mechanically. I want to express my particular gratitude at John McCabe coming here from Chicago. We're three representatives from the state of Oregon to this National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, and I think you can gather from the bills that we have an unusual number of them in length and scope here for you, but I think you can appreciate the type of task that organization tries to put out in terms of the quality of the work and the objectivity with which they try to attack that. Mr. McCabe is full-time, works with the commission and has been there, I think, at least 15 years or more years, and the national office has only a handful of employees. There's an executive director and an executive secretary and Mr. McCabe, and they then have some secretaries, and the balance of the work in this organization is all done by volunteer work from law professors, judges, and lawyers from the various states. And unfortunately, Oregon has not paid our national contribution, but nevertheless, John has agreed to come out here and support us and help us work through these acts, which are very beneficial to Oregon. So well, I do want to thank
you. Dip into the bank accounts of those high-powered firms that these commissioners come from, and I'm sure you could pay that indebtedness real easy.
Yeah, well, that argument has been made, but it's the state of Oregon that really receives the benefit from these acts, and so. Yeah.
That's certainly true. I've not kept track of how many different uniform acts we have adopted, but there have been a number of them, and it really has added value over the years. Didn't used to have as good a legislative council to draft things, Mr. Swank, as we do now, and it was really a help to us.
Well, the first limited Uniform Limited Partnership Act was adopted in 1916, and this is the first major change in it. I think it's been a product of over the past 20 years has been kind of an explosion in the marketing to investors of this type of investment vehicle involving general and limited partners. It's been felt that there was some need for increased consumer protection in that these are marketed across state lines, and the information available to the limited partner in the past has been quite limited and difficult to obtain. There's been an increased need for uniformity because of the need for predictability from state to state in as much as these are marketed across the country. This act also accomplishes the goals of modernizing and updating the law, which has been needed in this area for a good number of years. At the last count, there were 21 states that have adopted this revised act, and I don't know, 24 now. This act has been designated as a target act by the National Conference of Uniform Commissioners, in other words, a top priority act, and it is one which it is felt there is a great need for uniformity from state to state. I think rather than we've submitted written testimony going down section by section of the act explaining the change in Oregon law and so forth, and rather than go on with that, I think it might be beneficial if we have some of the other speakers, including John McCabe, Jim Larpenter on behalf of the business and corporation section, and of course Bob Lintott. I don't know if he's here.
Now Mark right Long's now. Here. Mark Long.
Yeah, yes, Mark Long.
Mark
well.
Long and Jim Larpenter are both here representing the Oregon State Bar Business Corporate and Corporation Business and Corporate section.
Okay.
So you're suggesting have them those two come up? Well, yes. I'll tell you what. Yeah, you gentlemen come on up, and Mr. McCabe, do you want to sit with them, or?
I'm whatever the committee would like. I'm going to have Mr. Lintott come up.
Well, everybody who wants to, everybody, that's fine.
I'll follow.
Make room and everybody can come up, and I want to welcome Judy Calkins, Wynn's wife, and a very good legal helper outer, paralegal, and Eugene. I didn't want to ignore her.
Good evening, Senators. I'm Jim Larpenter. I'm a practicing lawyer in Portland with the firm of Schwabe Williamson. I'm also chairman of the legislation committee of the business and corporate section of the Oregon State Bar. And that's the role I'm playing today in supporting, offering our section support and sponsorship to the Uniform Limited Partnership Act as it's been revised. I have with me on my left Mark Long. He's a lawyer practicing in Portland with our same firm. He's our technician. He's the gentleman who prepared the summary which I submitted earlier in the week to the committee. And on my right is Bob Lintott, Assistant Corporation Commissioner, who has some changes, modifications to make to the Uniform Act as Senate Bill 588 is submitted to you now. We support those changes as they are. So I think with that, I would ask Mark maybe to make a few remarks about the Senate Bill 588.
Start by telling us your name for the record.
My name is Mark Long. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Schwabe, Williamson, Wyatt, Moore, and Roberts in Portland, Oregon. And my comments will be very general. I first would like to emphasize that the revised Uniform Limited Partnership Act is not a dramatic change, nor does it affect the basic underlying principles that are now embodied in the Uniform Partnership Act codified in Chapter 69. Those principles and the essential nature of a limited partnership remains essentially the same. There have been some changes. Those are set forth in our summary. I think maybe our time would be better spent discussing the amendments proposed by the Corporation Commissioner. Would welcome any questions you may have drawn from that summary that we have prepared and distributed. At this time, if Bob would like to take over.
Okay, thank you, Mark. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I have here copies of the amendments, which you can part somewhat from the packet material that you have.
Is he saying they're different than what's in my book?
They're different from what's in your book, and that those were delivered at 11 o'clock this morning. The one that's now dated and timed 5 p.m. May 1st are the most current ones we have. And these reflect the deliberations of our meeting this afternoon with representatives of the Oregon State Bar.
Excuse me.
Have these been through legislative counsel's office at all?
No, they have not.
All right. State your name, spell your last name, and tell us your position, will you, please?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, legal counsel, I'm Robert Lintott. Last name spelled L-I-N-T-O-T-T. I'm Assistant Corporation Commissioner for the Business and Registry Sector of the Department of Commerce. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 588 and also to offer some amendments to the bill, which the Corporation Division of the Department of Commerce feels are necessary to establish greater uniformity and conformity among the ORS chapters governing business entities in Oregon. The set of amendments is offered to conform the proposed Uniform Limited Partnership Act to certain registration and other procedures contained in current statutes and in House Bill 2222 that is currently in the House Judiciary Committee. House Bill 2222 and these amendments to Senate Bill 588 streamline the processing of legal documents filed to create business entities in Oregon or to process amendments to those legal documents already on file with the Corporation Division. Our amendments include the same standard for accepting names of business entities for limited partnerships as is established in House Bill 2222 for all other business entities. That includes a change from the current standard of, quote, the same as or deceptively similar to the standard of the name being submitted must be distinguishable on the distinguishable upon the records of the Corporation Division from any other business entity name. The amendment also clarifies that the name of a limited partnership must be written in the alphabet used to write the English language and that it may include numerals and incidental punctuation. The amendment also includes a provision that recognizes the common law as it relates to property interests and property rights in the use of various business names. We have included certain requirements for mailing address and other identifying information for limited partnerships to parallel the amendments requiring the same information for all other business entities on file in the Corporation Division. We also propose an amendment which includes the initial filing fee and the first year license fee for both domestic and foreign limited partnerships. Our amendments include the mechanics for filing a certificate of cancellation, which the Uniform Limited Partnership Act calls for, and also sets out the specifics that must be contained in the certificate. Our set of amendments also includes the content of and the mechanics for filing the annual report that is required of all limited partnerships. Those mechanics are not currently contained in the language of the proposed Uniform Act. Finally, our amendments include language to clarify that general partners who are not natural persons and who will conduct business in Oregon on behalf of the limited partnership must be of active status on the records of the Corporation Division. We encourage your consideration and adoption of these proposed amendments. I'd be pleased to respond to any questions you might have concerning them.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Lindot? Sure. Senator Simmons.
Do these do violence at all to the concept of the Uniform Commercial Code, that it would make it difficult for someone in another state to conform to our procedures or to know what our procedures are?
Senator Simmons, Mr. Chairman, we believe that they would not do violence to the concept of uniformity. We have taken that one step further and provided for example, the contents of the required annual report for all limited partnerships, both domestic and foreign limited partnerships, to be contained in the face of that act, such that that would provide notice to those coming in from other jurisdictions, as opposed to burying that information in administrative rules.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you. Anything else, gentlemen? Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. McCabe, did you still want to testify on this?
Let me make one comment as to why you should adopt this act. And the answer is that with 24 jurisdictions having adopted the act, that essentially limited partnerships are more likely to go to other jurisdictions if the amendments are not adopted in the state. The amendments that are embodied in the 76 amendments are simply so congenial to the formation of limited partnerships that you run the risk of taking that business elsewhere. And with respect to the kinds of projects that are operated under limited partnerships, there very often are multiple site selections, multiple possibilities for filing the act. So you really want to do this for Oregon business as much as for anything else.
That's the question I was going to ask you. You know, if anything, if it's good for economic development, why the legislature will try and buy it.
About 60% of commercial real estate in the United States uses the limited partnership form for capital aggregation. That gives you an idea of how important this can be. So
it's important.
Just say that.
Have you looked over the amendments that are just given to us?
No, I have not. I haven't had a chance to see them. I listened to what they were. I should say I've never heard myself in any legislature object to amendments of that kind pertaining to this act from either a corporations commission or an office of the Secretary of State.
Go ahead. Your sense is that it doesn't change the intent and it doesn't change the...
No. These are pretty well administrative things. I suppose we might have tried to have dealt with some of those issues, the issue of more particularly with the issues of filing and with such things as report forms, although I think our aggregate sense would be that those are probably better handled at an administrative level than a statutory level, but if that's the way a given commission or Secretary of State's office wishes to handle them, we certainly would have no objection to that. The fact is that those are things, there are really two problems with trying to deal with those in a uniform manner.
I understand.
Your local procedures are not going to be uniform, right? I mean, your procedures are not the same as Oregon's. The same officials are not involved. And so we simply can't provide for them. But I heard nothing that would tend to make me think that it would interfere with the substantive performance of the act, and that's what would concern me.
That's my basic question. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Yes. One problem.
On the first page, on the first section of the act, it is drafted up to say the Oregon limited partnership is taking care of that.
We have the amendment in our book here.
Okay, fine.
And staff will be sure and remind us of that change that should be made.
Okay.
Changing Oregon to uniform. Okay, thanks. That'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 588. We have one bill left, Senate Bill 596. Three witnesses are signed up. John McCabe, Sarah Baker, and Stanley Loeb. And let's have let's have Mr.